This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. It's the weekend after Thanksgiving, and I don't know about you, but I'm wondering what to do with all that leftover turkey after I'm done making my grandfather's leftover turkey enchiladas, of course. So, as has become our tradition, we're going to fill this week's show with another kind of leftover. Small, easily digestible stories that just didn't fit into the show the first time around. Back in August, we told the origin story of baseball's wackiest team, a collegiate summer league club called the Savannah Bananas. The owner, Jesse Cole, is one of our more memorable recent guests.
I've been wearing a yellow tuxedo every single day at the ballpark since 2011, and I wear it every day now. Every single time I go to the airport, TSA does a double check on me because they think a crazy guy in a yellow tuxedo needs to be checked, and I agree with them.
One of Jesse's most memorable moments with the Bananas came on his team's opening night back in 2016. Only a Game's Matthew Stock has the story.
In the seventh inning of the Savannah Bananas' very first game, a woman came up to Jesse with a request.
Can you get me a signed baseball? She says, you have no idea how much that would mean to me.
Jesse's business philosophy is fans first. Start with the entertainment, and the baseball will follow. Hence, the yellow tuxedo, the breakdancing first base coach, and the bunches and bunches of banana puns. He told her he'd do it.
She goes, I'm here with my fiancé's whole family. He had come to every single opening night at this stadium since he was a kid, and he just tragically died 2 weeks ago. And we're here to pay tribute to him. And she said one more thing. His name was Drew Moody, and you have a player on your roster named Drew Moody. And I was blown away.
Bananas pitcher Drew Moody was still finishing his college baseball season and hadn't yet arrived in Savannah for the summer. But his younger brother, Logan Moody, was already playing for the Bananas.
So I went into the dugout and I told Logan about it. Logan rushed, got everyone's signature, and he said, I'd like to deliver the baseball to her.
The woman and her fiancé's family were sitting in the 4,000-seat grandstand at Grayson Stadium.
And I watched as Logan Moody, this 18-year-old, walked all the way up and delivered her the baseball. And he sat with her and the family for an entire half inning. And I watched as she gave him a huge hug with tears flowing, and I could see her say thank you. And he walked by me, and I said, Logan, what was that? He goes, it's fans first, right? This 18-year-old knew what it was all about. And at that moment, I realized, truly, we're on to something special. And it's about the memories we make and the moments that we create.
Despite a long pregame rain delay and a sloppy on-field performance from the Bananas, the woman and her fiancé's family stayed until the final out.
And they all gave me a hug as they left the ballpark that night. And that was opening night for us back in 2016.
Only a Game's Matthew Stock spoke with Jesse Cole back in July. Pat Gallant-Charette is the oldest woman to have swum the Molokai Channel in Hawaii, the English Channel between Britain and France, and the Suguru Strait in Japan. She set the first of her 9 world records when she was 60. She'll turn 68 in a couple of months. But as Pat says, age is just a number. Most of Pat's swims don't go swimmingly. Take her 2012 attempt at the Suguru Strait. After just 8 hours in the water, Pat glanced up and saw the finish line.
I really thought that for once in my lifetime, I was going to have a fast swim. And I was thinking, oh, wow, this is great.
Pat put her head down and kept swimming.
And then all of a sudden, I happened to look up and I couldn't see land anymore. And I said, what the heck? And I heard that they had these horrendous currents there. I had at least, another 20, 21 miles ahead of me. And it was like starting all over. And it took me, I think, 19 hours, 33 minutes. I had little fish nibbling at my fingertips.
Currents that drag you away from the finish? Fish nibbling at your fingertips? There's only one question I could possibly ask. Why? Why?
It's the challenge, and everything's so unique about each one of these swims.
These swims are the Ocean 7, a collection of the most difficult open water crossings. Since the challenge was established in 2008, only a dozen people have completed it.
And I've done 6 of the 7. One of the most challenging swims was the North Channel between Ireland and Scotland. Very, very cold water in the 50s, and they have these prolific blooms of jellyfish. and I got stung every inch of my body. Now, Molokai, it took me 23 hours to swim that, and I got stung by jellyfish there, and I've given birth to two kids, and I knew that with jellyfish, you know, it hurt, and then it's over. It's like labor pains, you know?
For Pat, it's the challenges she overcomes that make the swims worthwhile, and it's also the stories. Once she's back on dry land, Pat joins her family and her crew, and they have a good laugh about all of the bumps along the way. Like this one time during that swim across the Molokai Channel.
Usually you swim in darkness not to attract any unwanted fish. And I got bumped in the middle of the night, and they had to put the lights on.
Wait, you got bumped by what?
Well, they think it was dolphins. When I got bumped, I yelled, and they put the lights on. They could not see, you know, a shark. And I figured it wasn't because my leg was still there.
So Pat kept swimming, and she was rewarded, not just with another world record, but also by a pod of pilot whales that swam right up to her, almost close enough to touch. As day turns to night and night turns to day again, Pat keeps swimming. And during those swims, she encounters challenges and rewards most of us could never imagine.
One of my favorite encounters, when I was swimming the North Channel, I had this bird, it looked like a seagull, that landed right by my feet. And all of a sudden, another one, and another one. And there was like five or six of them. Well, they were paddling right behind me for like 5 hours. It looked like a little parade of seagulls.
Pat's crew records all of her encounters on video so she can show her fans and her grandchildren when she gets home.
Like Catalina, I mean, I had at the finish line nearly 100 dolphins surround me, and it was like an escort. My crew was so excited that the camera was moving all over the place and it was all distorted, but you can start to see the dolphins coming in.
Pat needs just one more swim to finish the Ocean 7, and she's already started taking on the Stillwater 8.
Those are the eight most challenging lake swims in the world.
Pat completed the Lake Ontario crossing last August, which had to be a piece of cake after all of those jellyfish stings and ocean currents and creatures that go bump in the night, right?
Well, I'll tell you, I had these little lampreys trying to, you know, wrap themselves around my feet. They felt like snakes, and I never kicked so hard in my life. These are the stories that, you know, after the swim is done, we sit down and talk about it, and I have a lot of good laughs. And my grandchildren, oh my God, they just love hearing about all these adventures that their grandmother's been on.
Since we spoke back in July, Pat Gallant-Charette has been on a few more of those adventures. She's now completed 4 of the Stillwater 8. But not all of Pat's adventures take place in the water. While in the audience for the Global Open Water Summit in San Francisco earlier this month, Pat was called to the stage for a surprise induction into the International Marathon Swimming Hall of Fame. Fritz Pollard is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He was the NFL's first black quarterback, first black coach. A little more than 100 years ago, Pollard endured death threats and racism as a Brown University running back. And while he was in school, he got good at making money. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Fritz Pollard III heard all the stories about his grandfather's time at Brown, like this one.
He was the best-dressed man on campus.
Pollard the Elder had some sharp threads of his own, but he augmented his wardrobe in a creative way.
No one liked to do laundry, so he would do their laundry in his dorm room and return it. Of course, he wore it also if something would fit him. So he got the nickname, he was the best-dressed man on campus because he was wearing everybody's clothes.
These days, such brazen money-making would send NCAA administrators to the fainting couch. But fortunately, the NCAA didn't have much power then. Pollard's industriousness attracted the attention of one very wealthy man who visited Brown in 1916.
John Rockefeller.
You and I know him as John D. Rockefeller, the oil and railroad magnate who became the wealthiest American of all time.
And John Rockefeller had heard about his little business on the side.
Rockefeller began his business career at age 16 in a similarly humble way, as an assistant bookkeeper at a small produce commission firm.
So he wanted to meet my grandfather, and he reminded him so much of himself when he was growing up and starting to earn his first money that he went and paid my grandfather's tuition.
That's another NCAA violation for those keeping score at home. But Rockefeller didn't stop there. He leased the empty dorm room adjacent to Pollard's.
And they cut a hole through the wall, so he had one room for his business and one room for studies while he was at Brown.
John D. Rockefeller had amassed his gigantic fortune by trusting his instincts. And his instincts told him that Fritz Pollard was a worthy and wise investment.
And he told him, he said, when you're done with this football foolishness, you come to New York and see me when you're ready to work.
Pollard never did work for Rockefeller, but they stayed in touch. After six seasons as a pro football player, Pollard pursued a business career.
Rockefeller gave him a loan, gave him a $29,000 loan that my grandfather used after the crash to start his business.
Pollard invested in two barnstorming football teams, the first securities firm owned by an African-American, a newspaper, and a talent agency.
He signed all these people, even Lena Horne.
Pollard represented dozens of other singers and actors, including Paul Robeson, a former teammate of his on the 1921 Akron Pros.
So if you needed black talent for a movie or anything, you had to come to my grandfather.
Fritz Pollard became wealthy despite Jim Crow laws and other forms of racism.
He had such an outstanding character that he didn't let anything get him down. He was just so positive about everything.
In the fall of 1972, Fritz III arrived in Providence, Rhode Island, to study and play football at his grandfather's alma mater.
When I was a freshman at Brown, I went into a store and I said, "Will you take an out-of-state check?"
He said he needed some new clothes. The cashier said she'd have to ask the owner.
And she went in the back and this little old man came out and he said, "Are you related to the Fritz Pollard?" And I said, "Yes, that's my grandfather." He goes, "Well, this money's no good." I said, "There's money in the bank." "No, no, no." He said, "No, your money's no good here. Anything you want, it's yours." He said, "My father took me to see your grandfather play when I was a little boy. And he said it was the greatest experience to see him run."
Only a Game's Gary Wallach spoke with Fritz Pollard III back in January. Back in July, we brought you the story behind the 1999 hit All-Star by Smash Mouth. Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. We told you how the band's one non-sports fan wrote the sports anthem of a generation, but we didn't have time to tell you how a member of Smash Mouth took a stand to save one of this country's most beloved sports venues. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Back in 1999, Fenway Park was in danger.
Its future was very much in doubt. It seemed like you maybe had a couple years left.
That's CBS Boston sports writer Michael Hurley. It may be hard to remember now in the era of green monster seats, $10 craft beers, and quadrennial championships, but back then the stadium wasn't exactly posh. Models had already been made for a new Fenway Park.
It seemed like it was going to happen.
Enter Smash Mouth. 2 months after the release of All-Star, Smash Mouth was invited to perform at Fenway before the 1999 Home Run Derby. The band was excited. Well, most of the band.
You know, I know it meant a lot more to the other guys.
That's Greg Camp, the band's non-sports fan who wrote the song All-Star.
But I understand it. I know what it is. It's like me, if I were to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something, or a museum that had a bunch of microphones in it, that's cool to me.
But then Greg arrived at the ballpark.
And I was like, "This place is cool, man. What do you want to rip this whole cool place down for?"
The performance began. Smash Mouth was on a stage in front of the right field bleachers, playing before a crowd of baseball fans who were presumably looking forward to a day in the not-so-distant future when they could watch a game in a seat wide enough for a late 20th century human. And then Greg Camp took the microphone.
I said something about, "Say Fenway," and everyone booed me. I got booed for saying that, and then the only thing that I saw was a billboard that said Dunkin' Donuts, and I went, "Dunkin' Donuts," and everyone went, "Yay!"
But is it possible that Greg's stand on behalf of Fenway Park started to change some minds, ultimately marking a turning point in the effort to save America's most beloved ballpark? Probably not.
And the funny thing is, I didn't know that they saved Fenway until you told me that. I thought they ripped that place down and put up a new one.
No, yeah, Fenway Park's a big deal.
Yeah, well, good. It's all because of me, and you're welcome.
Well, maybe not so fast. If you look back at old blog posts and newspaper articles, you'll find a few short mentions of Smash Mouth's Fenway Park performance. These stories confirm a couple key details: that "Save Fenway Park" was shouted, that the crowd booed. But these stories say that Smash Mouth's heroic member was not Greg Camp. They say it was lead singer Steve Harwell. Of course, we had to try to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, Steve Harwell, lead singer and co-founder of Smash Mouth.
So Greg told me that he shouted, "Save Fenway Park." Do you remember that happening?
No, I don't remember that, honestly. Pretty much, I was probably hammered at that time. Just to be honest with you.
Because Greg told me it was him, but then I read some old newspaper accounts that said it was you, so I wasn't sure who should get the credit for saving Fenway Park.
I always get the credit. You understand that? Daddy always gets the credit.
It's a mystery that perhaps never will be, or never should be, solved. But the next time you're watching the Red Sox, enjoying a $13.50 turkey tip sandwich, you can give a little thanks to Smash Mouth, someone from Smash Mouth, for standing up to save Fenway Park.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You're listening to Thanksgiving Leftovers on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
How often do people lie on dating apps? And are robots taking over our jobs? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of Planet Money's The Indicator, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. And that is the sound of pure evil. More specifically, Team Iceland coach Wolf the Dentist Stanson crushing a beach ball in an infamous scene from the 1994 film D2, The Mighty Ducks.
Playtime is over. We have the ice now. You and your little rink rats must leave.
Chilling, no? But listeners of our program last April learned that not only are Icelanders mostly kind people, they also don't really play much ice hockey. In this leftover story, Only a Game's Martin Kessler discovers that Icelanders almost achieved cinematic redemption.
Before D2 Mighty Ducks premiered in Reykjavik, producer Jordan Kerner tried to explain to the people of Iceland why their peaceful island nation had been tabbed as the villain in a major Disney production.
I got up and I spoke and I said, "You were chosen because we knew you could take it. Yeah, you were chosen because you guys are a beautiful, strong, wonderful people. And you were chosen because we could put black uniforms on you with a bunch of Viking faces, you know, on those uniforms that would seem scary to our ducks. And that you were extremely worthy opponents."
Jordan Kerner's Reykjavik speech was nice and all, but he actually had a much bigger plan to celebrate the people of Iceland. Before we go any further, I need to spoil one more movie for you. In D3, the last of the Mighty Ducks trilogy, the Ducks, fresh off their triumph over Iceland at the Junior Goodwill Games, go to high school. There's a new enemy.
All right, I've been doing my homework on the varsity. I'm not going to lie to you. You're good.
Team Iceland, the sports villain of a generation, is never seen again. Well, one actor from Team Iceland does reappear as the goalie for the varsity at this new high school, which has sparked some interesting conspiracy theories on Reddit. But this was not the movie that producer Jordan Kerner wanted to make.
I wanted to go back to the Junior Goodwill Games 2 years later.
In this story, the Ducks would, of course, meet Team Iceland again, but this time in the semifinals rather than the championship. Now, I want to make sure you're sitting for this next part.
And have the Ducks, for the first time, actually lose in the semifinals. Lose to Iceland, but what they came to understand was that Iceland, they were really good guys.
I know. Crazy. In this alternative story, Team Iceland actually stands up for a Ducks player after an even scarier opponent makes a thinly veiled anti-Semitic remark. So after losing in the semifinals, the Ducks, Kerner explains, don't just fly home with their tails between their legs.
They end up helping Iceland defeat yet another possible darker, angrier team.
The Germans?
No, not the Germans. And I have to admit, yet again, we chose a place that was smaller. It was Team Bulgaria.
Alas, it wasn't meant to be.
We had a whole big plot, and then the studio said, no, we want to be more domestic.
So Team Iceland never got its redemption. At least not yet. I spoke to Jordan Kerner again last week. He confirmed that a teleplay for a Mighty Ducks TV series is in the works. So we can hope that we haven't yet heard the last of Wolf the Dentist Stanson and his Iceland team.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. In 1909, Bill Kennedy fell from the top of the Des Moines Coliseum. The building was under construction. Bill was a bricklayer. Bill fell 5 stories, 65 feet. Luckily for him, he landed on a bystander. The bystander died. Bill survived. In the memoir he'd later write, Bill didn't describe how he felt when he was saved from certain death by causing the death of another man. He only said, my number wasn't up that day.
In the next paragraph, he says, after I recovered, I realized I was fit enough to keep running. That was pretty much, his first concern,
That's Patrick Kennedy, Bill's great-grandnephew. Later in life, Bill Kennedy, no relation to those other Kennedys, would become a rather famous marathoner. He'd win the Boston Marathon and travel the world for his sport. But in 1909, Bill was 25, and he had more pressing matters to attend to. He was engaged to the oldest daughter of a woman who owned a boarding house in St. Louis.
But when Bill returned, he found that the oldest daughter, who's named Nellie, got married to someone else and had left the home.
That's Lawrence Kennedy. He's Patrick's father and Bill's grandnephew. Lawrence says Bill was feeling down over losing the woman he believed to be the love of his life. So he did what any jilted lover who fell off the roof of a coliseum and survived by causing the death of a bystander might do. He married Nellie's sister.
And that was Jessie.
She always complained because the ring he gave her wasn't as big as the one he'd given her older sister.
Bill and Jessie had 2 daughters, and maybe because the couple didn't get along very well, Jessie had no objection to Bill taking off on long trips to run marathons. He'd ride the rails and sleep in train stations. When he arrived, he'd find a bricklaying job so that he'd have some money to take home after the race. So Jessie was okay with it. There was just one aspect of Bill's sport that Jessie could not abide.
Jessie had said to him, if you bring home another silver cup, I'm going to hit you with it.
Marathons were strictly amateur back then, no cash prizes. But that doesn't mean the winners went home empty-handed. Patrick learned about this one race when Jessie's warning came into play.
Yeah, it was the Yonkers Marathon. It was a bitterly cold day.
It was 2 days before Christmas. The winner had already crossed the finish line, his feet torn and bleeding from having been cut by jagged ice, when Bill Kennedy entered the Empire City Raceway for the final mile of the marathon.
He was running in 5th place, and as he entered the stadium, a friend of his called out and said, slow down.
The 5th place prize, he told me, was a camera. And the 6th place prize was a set of silverware.
That's an actor reading from Bill Kennedy's memoir.
I didn't want the camera. You'd have to buy film for it.
Whereas Jessie would probably like the silverware. That's a silver item that she could actually use. So he proceeded to fall and kind of wait there for the guy who's running in 6th place to catch up to him.
As the Tribune would later report,
to all urging and pleading, he refused to go on and waited for Joseph Carr, who was 1/2 mile behind, to overtake him. It was a long, cold wait out there in the backstretch.
And then he waited and waited, and after a while he stood up and apparently started to run backwards.
Finally, Joseph Carr, the 6th place runner, came into view.
Carr seemed none too eager to overtake Kennedy, but he was too cold to follow the Chicago man's tactics, and 1/4 mile from the finish line passed him.
And then Bill kind of trotted along behind him, but he still had to cut his stride the guy was just slower than he was, so he had to cut his stride, and then he kept stopping and tying a shoelace and stopping and tying another shoelace.
I could just picture this. There was nothing sneaky about it. It seemed so typical. He knew what he wanted, and he was going to get that.
Bill came in 6th place. He took the silverware home to Jessie. There's no record of whether she was pleased. But there is a record of something else. After Bill's death, Jesse didn't keep his most prized possession, the trophy he received for winning the 1917 Boston Marathon. Instead, that silver cup was kept by Jesse's older sister, Nellie. She proudly displayed it in the front room of her home for the rest of her life. There's much more from Bill Kennedy's life in the book written by Patrick and Lawrence Kennedy. It's called Bricklayer Bill, The Untold Story of the Working Man's Boston Marathon. Simone Augustus is a four-time WNBA champion. While playing for the Minnesota Lynx, she sometimes wears shoes custom painted with her favorite cartoon characters. She's a lifelong sneaker lover, but it all started back in the early 90s with one pair of shoes. Simone shared her story with Only a Game's Matthew Stock.
What was the first pair of basketball shoes that you remember owning?
I was like 6 or 7 years old. My mom told my dad to go and give me some basketball shoes. We had a game coming up. And we went to Lady Foot Locker, and my dad just basically walked in and was like, "What's your best basketball shoe?" And the young lady pointed us into the direction of the Jordan. She was like, "Everybody's coming in buying these, so I have to assume that these are the best."
You know, nobody in the world could cover my main man, Michael Jordan. Nobody, nobody, nobody.
Air Jordan 5s. The white, with the black and the red.
Nobody.
Now, here comes Jordan. Look out.
The price at the time, I think, was like $110. And it was well over our budget. Obviously, my mom wouldn't approve of spending $100 on my first pair of basketball sneakers, but my dad did, and he was like, "It should be just, don't tell your mother how much they cost."
Am I making myself clear?
Uh-uh.
New Air Jordans from Nike are here.
Uh-huh.
At that moment, I didn't know, you know, who Michael Jordan was. Like, I was becoming a fan, learning the game.
Look at the air. Look at the hang time. Look at the flying motion. Look at his head above the rim. They show him.
I just knew the shoes looked cool, and I was wearing them.
Yo, Mike, what makes you the best player in the universe? Is it the vicious dunks?
No, Mars.
Is it the haircut?
No, Mars.
Is it the shoes?
No.
When we got home, mom's like, "You got shoes?" I was like, "Yeah." Showed her the shoes. She was like, "Oh, they're beautiful, blah, blah, blah. Where's the receipt?" And I just kind of like walked off. I was like, "Oh, it's time for me to go."
Jordan for three.
Oh, yes!
My dad left the receipt in like his pocket. She was washing laundry and found the receipt, and she bit his head off for spending like $110 on my first pair of basketball shoes.
Shoes. You sure it's not the shoes?
I'm sure, Mom.
I loved them. They looked great. I looked good in them. And, you know, all the kids was like, "Oh, you got the Air Jordans on."
Edgar, 6'6", Michael Jordan.
That basically started the whole shoe thing for me.
With the first pick of the 2006 WNBA draft, the Minnesota Lynx select Simone Augustus from LSU.
Simone Augustus just completed her 13th season with the Minnesota Lynx. That story was produced by Only a Game's Matthew Stock. When Paul Stewart was just a kid, he went everywhere with his dad, Bill Stewart Jr. Bill was a referee, and he officiated football, baseball, and hockey games all over the Northeast. Paul grew to love sports, especially hockey, but his family didn't have a lot of money.
Longingly, I waited for my own pair of skates, and I didn't know we weren't rich.
In 1959, Bill Stewart stretched the family budget and bought Paul his first pair of hockey skates. They helped Paul parlay his hockey skills into a short pro career.
Secord and Paul Stewart go at it right away.
But Bill Stewart helped a lot of other kids, too, including one who would go on to fame of a cosmic magnitude. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Paul Stewart's stats from his final season tell you pretty much all you need to know about the kind of player he was. In 21 games with the 1979-1980 Quebec Nordiques, he scored 2 goals and racked up 74 penalty minutes.
For the record, if Stewart gets another 5-minute penalty from this altercation, he's through for the rest of the game. He also.
But Paul Stewart would go on to make a bigger name for himself as a well-respected NHL referee from 1986 to 2003. He became the first American to officiate more than 1,000 games. Sometimes his job brought him to Boston, where his dad, Bill Stewart, had taught and coached three sports at Boston English High School. When Paul visited, they'd watch Star Trek together.
And he'd elbow me a little bit and say, "Now there's an English high boy that did well for himself."
The boy in question was Leonard Nimoy. Long before he grew the pointy ears, Nimoy was a student of Stewart's. Cool, Paul Stewart thought. My dad taught Mr. Spock. One day, early in his officiating career, Paul Stewart was standing in line at the airport in L.A.
And I felt someone behind me. Referees have that sixth sense, you know. And tough guys do too, because they don't want anybody sneaking up. And I turned around, and there was this icon that I had seen on television hours and hours and hours watching.
To me, it is quite illogical to run up and down on green grass using energy instead of saving it.
I said, "Do you mind if I tell you a story?" He said, "No."
Stewart told Nimoy that his father had taught and coached him at Boston English High.
He said, "Who's your dad?" I said, "Bill Stewart." He says, "Ah, Coach Stewart." He says, "Does he tell you what a great athlete I was?" I said, "My dad told me you were a nice Jewish kid from Dorchester. Your dad was a barber. You always came to class on time. You didn't mess around, and you were barely adequate in track." And he laughed and laughed. And he said to me, "How is your dad?" I said, "Well, he's around the clubhouse turn. It's not going so good."
In 1987, Bill Stewart was suffering from congestive heart failure.
He said, "Can you send him a note for me?" And I said, "Yeah." And I gave him a card, and he wrote, "Coach Stewart, was always a pleasure. Leonard Nimoy. Mr. Spock."
Paul Stewart says his dad got a pretty big kick out of that. Bill Stewart died not long afterward.
You know, it's like a pebble in a pond. It ripples, and the energy keeps going. And I think that my dad had that effect.
Paul Stewart will be inducted into the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame on December 12th. Apparently, ripples spread across frozen ponds, too.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. A children's book, The Magical Christmas for Paul Stewart, was published in October. It was inspired in part by our story that aired last year. When we brought you the story of former fight doctor Linda Dahl, we didn't have time to tell you about her evening with Mike Tyson.
And I thought, this is probably the worst decision I can make, so why not?
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the unexpected connection between breast cancer recovery and dragon boat racing. But first, I'm here with Charlie Pierce for some of the tastiest tidbits from this week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The Cleveland Browns are looking for a new head coach, and reports have suggested a very interesting candidate. Who's that?
Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been rumored to be interested, not interested, but the Browns are rumored to be interested in having her coach. I think it's a great idea. I think they should hire 16 different celebrity coaches, one for each game. She could be the, like, if they want to save her for a real rivalry game, like with Baltimore or something,
sure.
That's fine. I mean, they could bring in Drew Carey to coach a game. It can't possibly be any worse than the Browns have been, right?
Amarillo, Texas has a new sheriff in town, or at least a new sheriff-themed minor league baseball mascot. Do you care to weigh in on the Amarillo sod poodles?
Yeah, I have to. Hang on just a second. I have to research this briefly to find out what a sod poodle is. Okay.
It's a prairie
apparently
dog?
It's a prairie dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it beat out the boot scooters, the bronc busters, the jerky. And the long haulers for the nickname.
Well, not to be outdone, the Colorado Sky Sox decided this week that Sky Sox is not a team that sells enough merchandise. So they went with...
The Vibes, man. See, Massachusetts, be aware. When you legalize weed, this is the kind of thing that happens. Not only are they now called the Vibes, man, They have a marshmallow for a s'more, essentially, for a mascot, which some people think looks like Guy Fieri. But I think it looks like a s'more with sunglasses on.
I think it looks delicious.
It does. It really looks tasty, doesn't it? The other options were the Happy Campers, the Lamb Chops, the Punchy Pikas, the Throttle Jockeys, and the Rocky Mountain Oysters. And once again, I warn, please do not overindulge in the newly legal spirits, because this is the kind of thing that can happen.
And finally, Charlie, a match at the Grand Slam of Darts came to a foul end last week, and I'm going to let you try to explain it.
I have to read the Guardian's lead. The world of professional darts has been rocked by two players accusing each other of repeatedly breaking wind during a match. Apparently, the universal darts law of who smelt it dealt it does not apply here. And I am not going to talk anymore about this story because I still have a career to take care of.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen. What's wrong with us this week?
We've all been there. You're watching sports on TV, and just when the phone rings, something amazing happens. Thanks to the wonders of the DVR, you can just rewind a few seconds and watch that great play over and over. And guess what? You can do the same thing with Only a Game. Subscribe to our podcast. You'll be able to rewind anytime you want, so you don't miss a thing. And while you're subscribing, leave us a review. It will help other listeners find our show. Back in August, we brought you the story of former fight doctor Linda Dahl and how she came to know and appreciate many of the fighters she met. The story we didn't have time to tell you concerns a particularly famous figure who's feared inside the ring and out of it. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Each year, there's a fight doctor convention. It's usually held in Las Vegas. Of course it is. Linda Dahl went in 2006.
And the guest of honor was supposed to be Oscar De La Hoya, and I was so excited because he was such an idol. I was all ready for him. And I showed up at the banquet, and they announced that he wasn't coming, but in his place, there would be a special guest.
Special guest? More special than Oscar De La Hoya?
Then there was kind of a rumble at the door, and I saw, you know, this man kind of walking towards us, and it was Mike Tyson.
Dahl certainly knew of Tyson's reputation. He'd spent time in prison on a rape conviction. He'd bitten off one opponent's ear. He once said that he wanted to eat another opponent's children. But she was starstruck as one of the greatest heavyweights of all time entered. Another fight doctor introduced her to Tyson.
He just started talking to me and took me to sit next to him at his table and started asking me all these questions, like what sign am I, and telling me about his pigeons.
Tyson was, and still is, a homing pigeon enthusiast.
And everybody's shooting all these pictures, and he kept saying, God, I wish these cameras would just go away. I wish we could just talk.
Dahl says Tyson focused on her to the exclusion of all the other guests, and she was captivated by him. They talked for a long time, and then...
The banquet was over, and I was leaving, and I just went to say goodbye to him. And he said, no, what are you doing? Come hang out with us. Hang out with us. And I just thought, that's so crazy. Why would he want to hang out with me? For some reason, he just wanted to chat. And almost like a little boy, you know, please, please, please. And I thought, this is probably the worst decision I could make. So why not?
Tyson and his entourage took Dahl to his hotel, to the back elevator where nobody would see them. When they got to Tyson's suite, it was just the two of them.
And it was a really surprising conversation. Like, he knew about Chechnya, where my father was from, and he was talking about the people there. He knew a lot about geography and culture, and he really didn't want to talk about himself at all. He just wanted to talk about me.
Dahl says Tyson rolled an enormous joint and smoked the whole thing himself.
I mean, eventually he just kind of passed out.
Dahl got up off the couch and kissed the slumbering Tyson on his forehead.
And I kind of snuck out with this amazing experience.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Dahl's book is To the Nail, The Making of a Female Fight Doctor. She'll tell you all about it if you let her, and if you stop asking about Tyson.
Oh, Mike. He's everyone's favorite topic.
After matches at major tournaments, tennis players are required to go into interview rooms. Win or lose, people like 2017 U.S. Open champion Sloane Stephens have to answer questions posed by people like me.
Having done this once, does it give you a hunger to win another slam, to do this again?
Of course, girl. Did you see that check that lady handed me? Man, if that doesn't make you want to play tennis, I don't know what will.
But when she's not making jokes about oversized checks, Sloane Stephens sometimes takes this opportunity to talk about food. No, really. Back in 2013, after advancing past the first round at Wimbledon, Sloane told reporters, "I want to get to Rajdhoot before it closes. We need to speed this up." Rajdhoot is an Indian restaurant in Wimbledon Village. Audio has not survived of this important exchange, but I have the transcript. Question, what do you order? Sloane Stephens. Well, normally I get the chicken tikka masala, but the last two nights I've gotten the chicken korma. Question, so is it superstition that you gotta go to Rajdhoot? Sloane Stephens. No, I really love it. I hate to tell you, Sloane, but I have someone who suggests otherwise.
You know, she starts winning, we gotta do the same thing. We eat the same breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So very much a superstitious person.
That's Sloane's coach, Kamau Murray. When Sloane won the U.S. Open last year, she was coming off a major injury. A month before the tournament, she was ranked 957th in the world.
So there weren't a ton of expectations. The only thing you could do is, you know what, let's control the controllables. Let's make sure we eat at a restaurant that looks safe and clean so we don't get food poisoning.
That was Coach Murray's plan. Sloane Stephens' plan was the same as it always is.
We eat the same breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Sloane isn't known for her health-conscious food choices. In June of 2017, when she was introduced as a member of the Philadelphia Freedoms of World Team Tennis, she told reporters, "I'm looking forward to having a cheesesteak and visiting the Liberty Bell." In March of 2018, as she was on her way to winning the Miami Open, she was asked what she'd miss most when that tournament moves to new digs next year. Sloane said she'd miss Sir Pizza. I can even tell you with authority that Sloane's favorite pizza is pepperoni dipped in ranch dressing. When Sloane Stephens advances through to the finals of a major tournament, Kamau Murray might be forced to eat the same breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 13 days in a row. But luckily, the day before last year's U.S. Open began, Sloane ate with her mother and a couple of friends.
I didn't eat with her not one time last year, so thank God, you know. Thank God her mother and her friends were here to keep her company and I could go eat somewhere else.
And the rest, as they say, is history. I spoke with Kamau Murray back in September. Our final leftover story isn't exactly a leftover. While researching Nike's history of socially conscious advertising last month, Only a Game's Martin Kessler came across a story that sounded too good to be true. So he looked into it and found that truth is definitely stranger than fiction.
Check, check. All right, we're in business.
Recently, I reconnected with New School history professor Natalia Melman Petrozella, who's writing a book about American fitness culture.
When we last spoke, everyone was talking about Colin Kaepernick and Nike's new Just Do It commercial. Do you think most people knew the story behind the tagline Just Do It?
Probably not. They've probably been inspired by it. They've probably made fun of it at some point. But I wouldn't say that the origin story is necessarily very familiar.
What is most people's reaction when you tell them the origin story?
They're really surprised.
The best place to start is the Utah State Prison on the morning of January 17th, 1977.
What was happening that morning was actually a very landmark event.
That's Timothy Bella, Morning Mix deputy editor at the Washington Post.
A man named Gary Gilmore was actually set to be the first person to be executed in the United States in a 10-year period.
The 36-year-old Gilmore had killed two men in Utah.
And he is set to be executed by firing squad. So a very brutal execution. And that day, he's in a plain T-shirt with a bag over his head.
Gilmore was asked if he had anything to say.
And his last words were, "Let's do it."
10 years after Gary Gilmore was executed, Nike was in a tough spot.
Yeah, so, I mean, Nike already was a big global company. There's no question about it. I mean, it had gone public in the early 1980s. It already had signed Michael Jordan.
That's Natalia Melman-Petrozella again.
But, you know, in 1987, they were having kind of a tough time. They had really missed the boat on aerobics.
Meanwhile, Reebok hadn't missed the boat.
And it's interesting to look at their annual report, and I'll just read a little bit of the statement to shareholders where they say, "In the vernacular of the Wall Street brokerage community, fiscal 1987 was a mixed year for Nike. It was a year in which sales dropped 18%, earnings declined 40% to 93 cents a share, and we struggled with market share."
Nike needed something to kind of change their way fast.
For Nike's next campaign, advertising executive Dan Wyden thought the company needed a tagline, and his firm, Wyden & Kennedy, happened to be based in Oregon, where murderer Gary Gilmore had also lived.
He remembered his "Let's do it" as this ultimate act of intention, and he just thought it was such a statement.
But then the rest of "Just Do It" comes from a very different source, which was Nancy Reagan's "Just Say No" campaign.
"Say yes to your life. And when it comes to drugs and alcohol, just say no."
And so, yeah, Wyden mashed those two up and put them together and came up with "Just Do It."
On the financial side, it had a huge impact and socially kind of opened people's eyes to what Nike could actually do as a brand.
Right. I was going to ask, like, would Nike be the Nike that we know it today if it wasn't for "Just Do It"?
I'd say probably not.
Petrozella isn't so sure. She says if there had never been "Just Do It," who knows what else Nike would have come up with. And as surprising as the origin of "Just Do It" may be, she says it actually captures the individualism, the "I'm in control" spirit of the 1980s.
I mean, even Gary Gilmore, when are you ever less in control of your life than when you're going before the firing squad? But it is an example of kind of taking agency over your own fate to say, "Let's do it." And then, of course, Nancy Reagan, the whole ethos of "Just Say No" is, you know, at the end of the day, whether you live in a neighborhood that's being ravaged by crime or whether there are drugs coming into this country, it's up to you to just say no.
So Petrozella says the Nancy Reagan convicted murderer mashup might seem strange, but the slogan "success" actually makes sense.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Timothy Bella and Natalia Melman Petrozella have both recently written articles about Nike and "Just Do It." We'll have links at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. We had additional help this week from Mike Lovell and Bob Schaefer. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.